WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm your host, Jason Mann. Before we begin, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, GredenzaPress.com. It is a wonderful website if you are looking to host a podcast or just need some publishing and other types of services. You should check it out at GredenzaPress.com. And it is how WrestleSpective gets to you through the magic of the internet, and it's lots of other wonderful podcasts as well. So so definitely go for it, GredenzaPress.com. And my guest today, returning to the program, he is the special WrestleSpective three-tiered cage correspondent, Bill Bicknell.
It's true, yes. Isn't it? It's true. We did the Doomsday Cage last time.
Yeah.
And I think that's what inspired me to say put me down for this at some point.
Right. And this is some point. So
it is some point. Some point has we can no longer postpone some
exactly.
Point.
This is Slammery 2000, the main event, headlined by WCW champion David Arquette taking on Diamond Dallas Page and Jeff Jarrett.
And boy, did everybody flip their lids when you announced this one on Twitter.
This is widely considered a debacle, a catastrophe, a horrible ruining of a sacred championship. Possibly the worst thing that ever happened in WCW's history. This is, I believe, the sentiment that
it is,
you know, most wrestling fans, you know, somewhere along those lines.
Right. It's down to either this or maybe Russo winning the title later in this
year.
Yeah,
or, you know, things like the finger poke of doom, Hogan putting Sting over cleanly at Starrcade 97. You know, those are all kind of different points in which people say, like, oh, that was the worst thing. It all went downhill from there.
WCW had a lot of worst things ever.
They did. Well, you know, everyone's allowed to pick their own, you know.
So
this is definitely maligned and terrible and all of those things. It's reputation. And while I would argue that it's not good, I'm not saying it was a wise decision, and I'm not defending it to a large extent. I will say that if WCW had been a strong, stable promotion that it didn't really – hadn't spent the last year and a half or more alienating most of its fans with poor storytelling, poor decision-making, not making, you know, use of its upcoming talent and having its stale, older talents stick around too long. If this had happened in a time in which WCW was thriving – I don't think people would have loved it, but I don't think it would have been as badly remembered.
No, absolutely not. This had been coming off of a period, and I would make the case that from about shortly after, I wouldn't say the finger poke of doom started it, but it was not long after that. From that period for about the next year was probably the worst period in WCW's history. In terms of pure storylines, in terms of things going wrong, in terms of the wrong people going over, you had ridiculous things like the Humvee angle and Randy Savage coming back looking like he'd been inflated like a parade balloon.
Yeah, Andy Harris too.
And on top of that, they just had the defection of Benoit and Malenko and Eddie Guerrero on Saturn. Yeah, that's right. And they had just, on top of everything else, just completely rebooted continuity just not 2 weeks before this. And so it's the culmination of a lot of bad things that really affect people like this. But luckily now it's 13 years later, we have the benefit of hindsight. So
yeah, exactly.
We can see
it's interesting to examine this, you know, that's what I like about doing this podcast is you can look back on a lot of things with some distance and not really be worked up in the emotion of the time of, you know, of the Monday Night Wars. And if you were like a big WCW fan, you're like, what is going on with the promotion that I love? It's insane. I hate this. You know, you can look at it with, you know, less of that emotional attachment and more just kind of like, oh, you know, was there any value in this or was it just completely random crap? But
And I should mention, as a matter of full disclosure, I had actually completely tuned out to WCW at the point when this happened. I was not watching a whole lot at the time. I'd stopped watching during that god-awful 1999 stretch. So I have seen this stuff before, but I was not in the position to feel like the WCW title was really something that could be salvaged at this point.
Right. Let's get into that a little bit later.
We'll talk about it.
Vince Russo comes in late 1999, in that fall, after WCW had, like you said, had like a pretty rough 6 months of bad storytelling, lots of bad things going on, but still not in necessarily like the most disastrous of shape. Like it still felt salvageable at that point, with just, you know, some smart decisions, some smart, you know, what have you. It wasn't necessarily a ship that was, you know, necessarily going to go down, but Russo took it into the direction that he had in WWE, much more fast-paced storytelling, just throwing things at you, you know, all the time, lots of swerves, lots of the, if you've ever seen Vince Russo book television, you know, you know what I'm talking about. And it's hard for me to believe that anybody listening to the show has not seen a Vince Russo type show. But so anyway, he lasted about 3 months. Then, early 2000, the radical defection that you mentioned came upon Russo being removed and Kevin Sullivan, who had led WCW in been sort of one of the main creative forces in WCW in, say, 95, 96, you know, even later on, put back in charge. They slow it down. But they've lost a tremendous amount of talent at this point because they don't have, you know, they lost the guys they lost Jericho, guys like that who had kind of held the, you know, had kind of been the glue that stuck things together. The main eventers were all getting older, were more stale. They'd all kind of been pushed. They brought back Flair and Hogan to try to get Flair and Hogan, you know, and another thing that had kind of worked. They brought things back to 1995, but it was all like, it was mostly the bad stuff in 95 and not really the good stuff.
And another iteration of the NWO at this point.
Well,
that was a Russo thing that sort of carried
over. Yeah, it didn't really last because Bret Hart got hurt. Kevin Nash was gone pretty quickly. The NWO really didn't. Like, it went a few weeks and then basically went away. I mean, Jeff Jarrett was there. He may have had the NWO shirt for a while, but that was really not something that carried any more than a month. It really, anything by the time Sullivan was in there, that was basically done. But yes, that was one of the recycled, you know, things that Vince Russo tried to do. So that ran its course and they decided, okay, hey, we're going to give Vince Russo another shot, but we're going to put Eric Bischoff with him this time. The idea of Bischoff being the kind of filter that Vince McMahon was in WWE, the idea that Russo has these creative ideas, but it just needs to be harnessed in a good direction. As you mentioned, the reboot, they have this really a pretty exciting Nitro that was April 10th, 2000, just about a month before this, the week before Spring Stampede. They vacate all the titles. They create this story of the young talent all rising together and against the established stars, which is a story I've always thought had a lot of potential if done right and has never really quite been done well.
No, because this was because then they tried the same thing in TNA with the main event Mafia and What was the Front Line? Was that the name of the other group? Something like that. I don't watch TNA,
right.
Or I
it's something
know,
like that. But it's like Cross the Line. I know that, but
yeah, but the face heel dynamic was right in that one, in that the main event guys were the bad guys, which led to a rare Sting heel turn. But that's a whole other story. But what we had here was interesting because for the most part, it was the younger guys who were meant to be the bad guys under the tutelage of Bischoff and Russo, and the older guys were the conquering heroes who were there trying to protect their spots. And so it was a weird dynamic.
It was weird. It kind of made some sense because I think the crowd was naturally more inclined to root for Hulk Hogan and those guys, and they were some of the guys they didn't know as well, or they didn't. It's easier to get those guys, the lesser run guys, over as heels than it would have been as faces, I guess, you know?
Right.
So in that sense, it made sense. But yeah, having a babyface stable called the Millionaires Club was a very real WCW thing, you know?
And if you know anything about Bischoff's politics, it kind of makes sense.
That's a good point. Yeah, there you go. So that leads to some brief excitement and interest, but quickly it is kind of the same old thing that Russo always does, and leads to in the period between when Russo took over through Bash at the Beach, Bash at the Beach 2000, which was July 9th, which is the famous Vince Russo Hulk Hogan shoot promo situation. I've done a podcast on before, which you should listen to because it's good. Well, maybe you've listened to it, Bill, but I mean the listeners, if they haven't listened to it,
I have never listened to it.
You should listen to it because it's pretty good.
I should listen to it.
I'm impressed with it, and I don't impress easily. Okay, Jeff Jarrett wins it 6 days after that Nitro at Spring Stampede.
Spring Stampede.
Eight days.
They had a tournament,
yes,
by the way.
Eight days later, Diamond Dallas Page wins it on Nitro. And he's able to win it because David Arquette beat Eric Bischoff in a match earlier that Nitro. Mm-hmm. In a match in which he does a spear and the worm.
You know what's funny? The only thing I didn't watch in preparing for this was the Bischoff-Arquette singles match.
It was like 3 minutes, and it was actually reasonably entertaining.
Right.
Surprisingly, not like a terrible athlete. He shows a bit in the mat.
Mm-hmm.
His worm was not so good, but he had enough panache that he kind of pulled it off. So.
Right. And one thing about Bischoff is that he's always been willing to make himself look like an idiot for the good of a storyline.
True.
And there's a lot of points in this where he does that. So I'm not surprised at all that it was pretty good.
So then the next Thunder, 2 days later, there is the mixed tag match of Paige, the champion, and Arquette against Jarrett and Bischoff.
I guess it's kind of mixed.
Yeah, I guess mixed is maybe not the right word exactly, but mixed in terms of the feud. Arquette pins Bischoff to win the title because the title changed hands under those circumstances.
It's a strange finish because Jarrett is pinning Paige at the time, and I guess Arquette was legal, but I didn't see him tag. There was a second referee, and there's a whole lot of shenanigans involving Kimberly, who was split up with Paige. There's a lot of shenanigans in this angle, basically.
I don't think I mentioned that Kimberly turned on DDP to enable Jarrett to become champion.
Right.
Is actually not really that important, but we're.
Yeah, she doesn't figure at all into this until after.
Yeah,
this
she's
point.
On. She's in the next night. The promo that you made me. Well, you didn't make me watch it, but you sent to me mm-hmm. that we're going to talk about that occurred the Nitro after this because it's amazing.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah. So that happened the next Nitro, which is May 1st. David Arquette against Tank Abbott.
And everybody was really mad about this, as I recall, because Arquette technically retains the title.
Right.
And so people were mad. Oh, he beat actual wrestlers to retain the title. I'm going, it's Tank Abbott.
Well,
and I don't know. I can't get excited about Tank Abbott. I'm sorry.
I mean, it wasn't like he actually pinned him, obviously. I think he does, but
there's kind of a schmaz finish. It's a DDP gets a diamond cutter, and the whole angle is predicated on the idea that Arquette doesn't really want the belt, and it kind of feels like he's in over his head.
And there's an excellent very brief moment of David Arquette and Courtney Cox in a pre-tape about and Arquette at this point, he's more deluded and excited to be the champ, so he kind of back and forth on that a little bit, on whether he wants or doesn't want it. Courtney Cox is like, "Hey, you're not a wrestler, buddy. You know, what are you doing here?" And correct me if I'm wrong, that's Kurt Russell, right?
Yes, Kurt Russell shows up because Courtney Cox was filming 3,000 Miles to Graceland, I think. Weird Elvis heist movie.
Right. So I don't
remember, with Kurt Russell
being in that, but obviously she was. So and then David, he says, you know, to Kurt, so have you heard that I'm WCW champion? And then Russell just has this priceless look. He's like, yeah, right, buddy. You know, and, right. That's good. That was a moment of levity. That was a moment I enjoyed in this buildup.
Right.
Yeah. And nothing about it, like, you know, I thought was terrible. You know, the moments that I had. Now, obviously, I get in the context of what WCW is going through, not so good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to recount also the remaining title changes, even though we're skipping ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I think most people know who's going to win this match anyway, so we're going to spoil it early.
Right.
Jeff Jarrett ends up winning the championship here.
No!
8 days later, Ric Flair beats him on Nitro. Then I believe in real life Flair had some sort of health scare on Thunder and then is stripped of the title on the next Nitro. Jeff Jarrett wins it back by beating Kevin Nash, but on the next Thunder, Nash beats Jarrett and Scott Steiner in a triple threat match to win the title. Then Nash on the next Nitro returns the belt to Flair. And then later that evening on Nitro, Jarrett
beats him for something.
I believe that Russo also shaves Flair's head.
Right.
No, I take that back. That's not that night. That's like the.
No, that happens a little bit later, I think.
Because it's like there's like a Russo Flair cage match. Russo's like in the figure four for like 90 seconds and doesn't give up.
Right.
And then there's a whole 5 weeks that go by before there's another title.
I know. It was incredible. It was like five whole weeks with Jarrett as the champion. It was amazing. Keep in mind, by the way, Jarrett, May 29th was when he won the title. He had first won the WCW title for the very first time on April 16th. By May 29th, if you're keeping track, he was now a four-time WCW World Heavyweight Champion.
And that was his last win, actually. It
was.
He never won the WCW title again.
I'll be damned, huh? So Jeff Jarrett, four-time WCW champion, held the title for maybe a total of like 3 months.
Not even that. He probably held it for probably 7 weeks. So,
right.
So anyway, White. So my argument is that all that stuff. That, I think, was worse than the individual thing of David Arquette headlining as champion.
Exactly. There was so much just surprise for the sake of it, so much throwing the belt around back and forth. You know, for as much as people complain about, you know, Miz beats Barrett, then Barrett wins the next night, they had nothing on WCW at this point.
Right, yeah, and obviously everything that Arquette does is presented as a fluke. He's not an actual athlete. I mean, you know, even like someone like Shane McMahon or Vince is presented as much more of like a
physical threat.
Yeah. So,
and we should mention, by the way, Arquette spends most of the match that we're talking about cowering, running away. He gets a few shots in, but he's never made to look stronger than anybody.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, a lot of complaints to this are centered around the idea that Arquette's holding the belt that somebody else reasonably should be held. But that's the story.
Right. Yeah.
That's the point.
Now, I will say, like, and I actually went and looked at the Nitro ratings for around this period. and just because this is sort of considered like a watershed moment of like, oh, WWE died during at this point. So I wanted to see if there was any sort of like ratings, difference that.
Downward momentum.
Yeah.
Right.
So the Nitro in which he won the title did a 3.1, or I'm sorry, right okay. before the Nitro that he wrestled Bischoff did a 3.1. The next one, his
right.
champion does go down to 2.5, but then it's with a 2.8, right. a 3.2, a 3.0, and a 3.0. Basically, in the high twos and the and very low threes. Up until the summer, in which they dip into more into the mid twos, and then there's kind of brief. There's a brief period right in the late summer, early fall, where they go back into the threes, and then they pretty much stick around in the mid to low twos through the rest of WCW's tenure.
Right. So there's some dips there, but it's not. It's not really a turning point.
No, there's no evidence based on that there is a turning point. I haven't checked the buy rates recently, but I'm pretty sure that they were all really, really bad, and they pretty much stayed. It already pretty much like minimumed out already to the point.
Right, and that is something that got tossed around. I believe it was in. God, I even shudder to talk about Death of WCW because it's such a crap book, but that's a whole other long conversation. But I believe they do mention that the buy rate for Slamboree was supposedly pretty low, however much stock you put in there.
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, I don't doubt that it was bad, but I don't think it was like...
It wasn't historically bad.
Worse or better than anything. I mean, they were historically bad at this point.
Right.
So obviously, you know, business... favorite thing, but I do think in the context of David Arquette was the worst thing to ever happen. That's sort of an important thing to that. I'm not sure that the evidence that we have, which is limited, bears that
right.
out. Now, you know, granted, it right. could have been turning off more of WCW's core audience and bringing in like a bit more of a fad audience. But
right.
you know, regardless, the numbers don't really lead to that conclusion or lead to a conclusion that they were
right.
hemorrhaging viewers any more than they had been over the past year. So,
right.
Basically it for the build that of note. So anything else that you can think of to the match?
As far as the build, no, not really.
All right. Well, we're in Kansas City, by the way, which is important to note toward the end here. Jeff Jarrett is out first. Michael Buffer informs that he's the man on the mission and refers to him as the former WCW heavyweight world champion.
Oh, Michael Buffer. I'm surprised he didn't make him a member of the Megaforce.
He didn't. You know, unfortunately, the version of this that I watched, Buffer was never seen, only heard.
Right.
So I did not, I'm not. Action critique of Michael Buffer's outfit as I normally would on, which makes me sad.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. Don't worry, we can critique an outfit here in a second. We will have an outfit to critique.
We have David Arquette, who comes out to the version of "We're Not Going to Take It" by Biff Naked.
Biff Naked. That's her name. Is it a her or a they? It was not occurring to me who that
yeah.
was.
You mentioned during the commentary, but.
Okay. I must have missed it.
But Biff Naked, yes, is. And it is drowning out Michael Buffer's introduction of David Arquette. You're hardly able to hear it, but honestly, I don't think anyone was paying attention to anything other than the orange jumpsuit that David Arquette was wearing.
He was like some kind of Satan Elvis. I don't know what the hell that was.
He wore a gaudy outfit in his Hank Abbott match as well. And it was like,
And he wears a gaudy outfit the next night.
Given what he, after the action match, that he would wear the gaudy outfit,
right.
character. But I mean, you know, it's not really anything that's a big deal, but because, you know,
right.
sort of a silly guy anyway, but, and it fits fine for that, but
right.
yes, it is definitely one of the louder outfits that I've seen in a lot of early 90s Macho Man.
Right.
So David Arquette looked concerned. Our announcers, who are Tony Schiavone, Scott Hudson, and Mark Madden,
Oh,
concern
God.
on his face. I will say that those three are definitely by far not my favorite commentary team, particularly Mark Madden.
Oh, God, Mark Madden.
I would say that Mark Madden didn't do anything to piss me off.
Not in this match, no.
And I do think that it was, he said something amusing during the Bischoff Arquette match of, I believe it was after a low blow by Bischoff, in which that Madden expressed surprise that Arquette felt the effects of that because he felt as though he had been castrated by his wife, which, I mean, which is, obviously sort of the plays into the whole like sexist thing of of a man is
Right.
emasculated by, being in a relationship with a woman who's more famous or more powerful, or makes more money or whatever. At the
Right.
moment, I did kind of laugh at that. So
Well, fair enough.
I'm not perfect. I laughed at myself. So.
That's all right. That's all right. It's okay. And to be fair, it is Courtney Cox and David Arquette, so
That is true. So, and then Diamond Dallas Page comes out, basically the usual intro. I kind of recall Page sort of revamping himself a little bit. Like obviously he'd lost the mullet at this point. He wasn't wearing the jeans. He was wearing tights and had short hair. The music was still the same. I recall him. I thought he changed his music at some point, but it hadn't happened at this point.
He may have later in the
Yeah.
year, I want to say, but he's still using the Smells Like Teen Spirit
Yeah, right.
knockoff.
Yeah. So,
And Jarrett, we should mention, if you've never heard his music, he has a knockoff of Cowboy by Kid
no, it's not a
Rock.
knockoff. It's actually the song. I
Is
believe it
it?
is. Yes, I believe they actually had the rights.
Wait a minute. Hang on, hang on, hang on. You mean that WCW paid Kid Rock money so that they could use his music for Jeff Jarrett?
Well, I
Whereas WWE paid Kid Rock money so they could use his music for The Undertaker?
yes, I guess. I mean,
Is there any doubt who won this war? My God.
I like Jeff Jarrett, but
He's all right. I have a higher opinion of him than Holzerman apparently does, so.
well, but yeah, there it's not bad intro music. I mean, I like Kid Rock, but as far as like,
It fits him.
I'm 95% sure that is actually the song.
I did not know that,
Around the
huh?
time that WCW had like one thing that Russo did do is he entered his he brought in a little bit more modern music. And that may have actually been something that they were doing before he even got there. That might have been the works. I mean, things kind of slow at Time Warner, but they had a WCW Mayhem album, and they had, Sting came, switched to the Metallica song that he played. They
Right.
started bringing in some more modern music and using some commercial music that they, I, you know, were able to have, I get, probably through the relationship with Warner Brothers, if anything else.
Right.
And that was an improvement in WCW, and they had some production improvements as well during that time. So it wasn't all sourness with Russo, but it was just 95%.
Right. And mostly in, as it pertains to the stories and the angles and things like that.
Exactly, which are important, I would
Right.
argue. Yeah. So, David Arquette right away runs away from Jeff Jarrett. He tries to climb a cage little bit. Jarrett chases, but DDP attacks him from behind. A lot of DDT, a lot of Page doing sort of nefarious things to Jarrett during match.
Right, a lot of throwing him into cage walls, knocking him into ring posts and stuff like that. Double teaming him. They mentioned at one point that Page wants to use Arquette when he needs him to, which is kind of a bad guy thing to do. So it's kind of a weird dynamic at
Is
first.
yes. So he tosses him into the cage, or Page tosses Jarrett into the cage, but then as Paige gets into the ring, Jarrett catches him and takes a little bit control, but then immediately Paige nails, or I guess Jarrett, who hit the DDT?
Jarrett hit the DDT and then went after
yeah,
Arquette.
That makes more sense. For some reason, I think it was Paige, but yes. DDT, chased after Arquette, then runs into a DDP clothesline as Arquette jumps in the ring. And Arquette does a nice, like, jump over the ropes as well. Like, you know, showing a little bit of athleticism there. And we have, like, a series of reversals that lead to a DDP, another DDP clothesline, and then he nails sort of his version of the rock bottom, which I totally forgot he did.
Right.
It seems weird since Booker was there, but, you know.
Well, Paige started doing a lot of rock sort of stuff. I think when Russo came in, I might be mistaken.
I feel like he would. I feel like he might have done it more like early on in 99, because he was kind of doing, he was kind of playing off the rock a little bit, and then when he turning, he was also kind of sort of a, you know, a pre good guy rock shtick, for lack of a better. Anyway, yeah, so he did that. Then Arquette, then like he sets Jarrett up for Arquette, and Arquette goes to the top rope and misses a top rope splash.
Right. DDP doesn't even hold him there. Thanks a lot, jackass.
I'm shocked that Arquette do that.
And you know what? Honestly, it was a good jump.
Yeah.
He got good air. It's kind of a superfly splash sort of thing with his arms up. So,
you know, I mean, he missed it, but he landed, like, it looked good. You know, that was weird.
Right. And a big part about what makes this work a little better in hindsight is the fact that Arquette actually looks like he wants to be there.
Yes. Right.
He's having fun, and that's what makes it different from Rodman. When he would show up, he would just look like he was just phoning it in constantly.
Yeah. No.
But Arquette seems to be enjoying himself.
The first Rodman match was a lot better than the second one.
Yeah, that is true. That
second
is
one
true.
He definitely did. I think the first one he's more motivated, more in there. And there's a hardcore match with him and Randy Savage is actually pretty good too.
Was it Hog Wild or Road Wild or I know what you're talking about though.
Which I've not seen in a long time, but I recall enjoying it. So.
Well, all right.
And then Paige, again, tossing Jarrett into the cage a couple of times. It's at this point in which Tony talks about the very close relationship between Diamond Dallas Page and David Arquette. And in fact, he says it specifically, they became very close in the filming in October, or during the filming in October of last year of Ready to Rumble. So, that's Tony Schiavone phrase right there.
of last year of Ready to Run. He loves those prepositional phrases.
And they became very close during filming. Cool, you know. Mm-hmm. So fine, gets beaten up for a little bit. Paige tries to bring a ladder into the ring. Jarrett ends up landing basically slide on it to briefly get the advantage, although pretty much immediately Paige is Jarrett into Arquette, I guess, and then takes control again. Tries to crotch Jarrett into the post, but pulls his legs in, and Paige nails the post again. And then Jarrett tries to clothesline Paige, but Paige ducks, and Arquette is hit again. So,
poor Arquette.
The match so far. Mm-hmm. Then Paige picks up Jarrett and rams him crotch first into the post. So he finally gets that.
He gets it, yep.
And then Tony explains Jarrett's motivation in this came in that the fact that he came in October when the filming was occurring, but was mad that it wasn't made part of the movie.
Right, exactly. And I was trying to figure out when it was filmed, because it didn't make sense to me that Jarrett would, because Russo's first pay-per-view was Halloween Havoc in 1999, and Jarrett came over with Russo at the same time. There was a weird timeline.
Facts on that. But I guess, you know, okay. And then he says that, like, Arquette came into play later, which I can't, like, I don't, I can't fathom exactly how they made that logic exactly, but okay.
All right, whatever. It's kind of consistent if you look at it
I mean,
cockeyed,
I guess the
so.
motivation is fine. I mean, but the idea that, like, because I mean, he would have been a matter of Arquette as much as Paige. So I guess Arquette winning the title made him part of the match, and before he wouldn't have been a part of it. But
Right.
so anyway,
Right.
I so Jarrett's bleeding a bit at this point. Paige
Right.
works it over. Some more tossing into the cage. I should mention at this point that, like, Jarrett and Paige have a fairly energetic brawl. Standard, but enjoyable enough.
Yeah, there's nothing really fancy about it, but it's spirited. The cage has a lot of give to it, too, which is one thing about it. And we talked about this as it pertains to the Alliance Ten Hulkamania against the Megaforce. That one of the things that really hurt that match was the camera work was completely off in it.
Yes.
And it was impossible to see anything. This is the polar opposite of that. Because the cage is a great visual in and of itself. It's right out there front and center for the crowd to see. The crowd is within just a few feet of the cage. It's a big Hell in a Cell type cage that envelops the bottom ring is. And so there's a lot more interaction, it's a lot better filmed, and it makes a much better visual. And it really is what I think takes this match up a notch.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So DDP tries to climb the ladder, and then Jarrett is able to hit a back suplex off it. And then Jarrett then tries to climb himself, and then Paige hits a sit-out power bomb. And then Paige tosses Jeff into the ladder twice, but Jarrett reverses it a third time, then drops the ladder on his ribs. So we're getting some good shots of the ladder. We're getting some. I would say that this is a little bit harsher than I normally see matches involving Jarrett and DDP.
Exactly. It maybe harkens back. Paige actually had a feud with Raven in 1998 that had a lot of
That's
physicality in
true.
it.
That's true.
So it sort of harkens back to a lot of that, I
Yeah.
think.
I don't know if the stuff was set up quite as cleverly as some of that. I think Raven was kind of good at, like, kind of bringing in some of the stuff in a more organic way sometimes.
Well, and yeah, and that's the difference. Jarrett's more of kind of a typical Southern wrestling mat style heel, and Raven is Raven.
Sure. Yeah. Mark Madden brings up, he calls it irony of one of the richest prizes in wrestling being contested in a match without wrestling, which I feel like happens a lot. And so I don't know. I feel like that's an observation that Mark Mann did not need to make.
And he kept calling it irony over and over, and it's like, kinda, I
Yeah,
guess.
maybe it's a little more
I
than
guess.
irony. Yes.
It's a thing.
So another ladder is brought in, and then Jarrett gets on top of it, and then Paige tips it a bit to knock Jarrett down. Then they're both to get on top of the ladder, punch each other. Paige grabs the top of the cage, kicks the ladder to knock Jarrett down, and then Paige is able eventually to make it up to the second floor.
Hardcore
The hell
hell.
is the second stage?
The first cage, by the way, does not have a
No.
name. I dubbed it Punchy Purgatory.
I like that. Punchy.
The third cage has a much lamer name, which we'll get to.
Are we going to get to it? I missed that name, so.
Oh, the third cage is called the Guitar
The
Room.
guitar room. Ah, okay.
The guitar, not like Guitar Kansas or anything, just the Guitar Room.
So Paige is up there in hardcore hell. Paige immediately grabs a bolt cutter, which opens the door immediately.
Right. Just
Any
right
drama
away.
from that whatsoever. Jared, though, attacks him, sneak attacks right away because he's able to get up fairly easily because, no one's preventing him from getting down.
Right. And
Yeah.
hardcore hell, by the way. The gimmick is it's Russo seems to love this gimmick of taking a cage and lining the side of it with weapons.
Yes.
And that's what hardcore hell is, by the way. So it's on the roof of the previous cage. So you've got kind of the wiry cage, bouncy sort of thing going on that we saw with the Doomsday Cage match as
this
well.
This footing seemed much more sure than, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's essentially a ring-sized cage about on top of the bigger Hell in the Cell-sized cage structure.
Right.
So there's some plunder in there. Jeff nails Paige with a cookie sheet, also with a serving tray. And we cut to Arquette watching from the ring. He takes him a long time to recover from that clothesline that knocked him down. But
it's brutal, man.
He looks up, he's sort of dumbfounded about what to do. And then we go back up there. Paige is bleeding. Paige sends Jarrett into one of the walls of the cage, and they both go through. And then the announcers kind of bring up the fear here, and they bring it up several times of, oh, they're going to fall off the platform because they're getting pretty close to it.
Right.
Paige tries to set up a table on the cage floor, which is wobbly, but he's able to sort of power slam through it anyway. So it comes off okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was scared to death for that spot when I saw it. I said, this is not going to go well, but then it ends well. And that's really kind of the story of this angle is I'm not sure that's going to end well. Oh, it kind of went okay.
Right. Yeah, so Jeff tries to climb, but Paige nails him with the chair. They trade blows, kind of walking around the platform. Jeff tries to do an Irish whip to send Paige off, but he's cut off by Paige's elbow. So unable to do that.
Right.
Then Arquette climbs up into the second tier and then sort of sneaks up to the top around the fighting that that Paige and Jarrett are doing. The announcers sort of speculate to his motivations. Then Madden says that he thinks that Arquette's there to keep Jarrett from winning, which makes sense. And it's weird. It's the only time I think that Mark Madden has ever been the smartest guy in the room.
It's set your calendars. It was a miraculous moment. Mark it on your calendars.
Then suddenly Mike Awesome out of nowhere.
Where did he come from?
I assume he must have climbed from the outside, I guess, but
it was weird because the crowd didn't seem, the crowd usually pops or something like that when somebody comes out. I didn't even catch that.
It was a
hot crowd anyway. The crowd was very excited, but it's just like out of nowhere. Bam, Mike Awesome
shows up. He attacks Paige, but Paige is able to hit a low blow and a diamond cutter to subdue Awesome. Then they manage to make it up to the third level, which is a very tiny cage, which has basically like four guitars hanging up. And they both swing the guitar shots and miss. And I did like sort of the chaos of them wielding the guitars in that small room and trying to attack each other. That was kind of a cool visual. I enjoyed that. Like, it's hard to make use of that small space, and they didn't stick with it very long, but what they did I thought was good.
Right. And yeah, it's just they swing at the guitar, one guy ducks, it shatters against the wall. It makes a really neat visual, and there's a lot of that in this match between that and the size of the cage and all that. Lots of cool stuff to look at here.
Paige then sort of hands Arquette a guitar, and Arquette is standing on top of that third cage right below the title belt. 42 feet in the air, we are told many times.
Yes, 42 feet, exactly 42
there you
feet.
Go. Maybe that's what Douglas Adams was talking about.
Maybe.
While DDP is handing Arquette that guitar, Jarrett low blows him, but I guess, and I'm not clear exactly. I forget if the camera just wasn't great or if I just missed it in my switching from note taking to watching. But Jarrett's head is slammed in the door.
Yeah, okay. His head gets slammed.
Is that shown
in the
well, or
they kind of missed the shot.
All right. And this is at this point, Mark Madden. This is sort of an out of context quote, but says that there is so much violence you are almost numb to it. And this is kind of the philosophy of WCW in this time. So much you are almost numb to it.
Exactly.
So you get both Paige and Jarrett recover, and they're climbing up on the same side of the small cage, but on the opposite sides of that side. And Arquette then is up there holding the guitar, and then I don't think he even does like the fake "I'm gonna hit Jarrett." He just immediately hits DDP.
No, he just wails on DDP with the Jarrett
right.
guitar.
And DDP falls, and Jarrett climbs up. He and Arquette hug, and then he grabs the belt. And Tony calls it as, it's the ultimate swerve, 42 feet in the air.
The ultimate swerve. Incidentally, the word ultimate also means final, and this was certainly not the ultimate
it was
swerve.
Not, no.
This was not even the penultimate swerve.
No, it was...
This
thousandth to ultimate swerve.
Yes. We had a long way to go before we would get the ultimate swerve.
Yeah,
I think.
Yes. I guess probably Shane. I guess Vince McMahon. Not
Shane McMahon buying WCW was the ultimate swerve. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Mike Awesome grabs Paige and tries to attack, threatening to toss him off. Then Paige's buddy Canyon runs in to help.
Out of nowhere again.
Yeah. And then he is tossed from atop the cage into the entrance ramp, which is padded.
It's very clearly a gimmicked stage. You can tell the minute he hits it.
So, how do you feel the crowd reaction is to that?
The crowd reaction seemed very positive.
Okay.
I think I caught a little... Did I catch a little bit of a holy shit chant? I don't know.
Might have been one, yeah.
I don't know, because they went off the air almost immediately after
right.
it.
I mean, the announcers go crazy and are like, oh my God, is he okay? You know, so
yeah.
They play it pretty strongly.
I don't think they quite use their own voices, though. You know, they're not going into full-on fans. We apologize that you just witnessed that.
No, they didn't do anything like that. I mean, they played it as an angle, not as we were supposed to believe.
Right.
For lack of a better term, and, you know.
And that's why we mentioned that this was in Kansas City, because this was the same arena where Owen Hart had fallen.
Yes.
Was it like a year? It was like a year before this.
Yeah, almost exactly a year before this. So yeah, it was Kemper Arena. So well, let's address the Twitter question now of Q-ish reviews asking if the Canyon bump was tasteless since it was in the same arena. Do you think they were trying to think did you get the sense that's like what it harkened back to?
I don't think it was meant to play on that at all. It seemed to – they spent so much time building up the size of the cage and the height of the cage that it was sort of a – it was a Chekhov's gun kind of thing. Chekhov's gun, the idea that if you put a gun on the mantle in the first the first scene, it better go off by the end of the first act.
Right.
You know, it's something that they had built to the point where you get the feeling somebody's going to go off that cage. And it was closer, I think, not quite as – obviously not as iconic or anything like that to Shawn Michaels or Mankind's fall off of Hell in the Cell. That's what it felt like to me.
Right, and I think that's what they were going for. Now, they may have been trying to get heat by being in Kansas City and trying to get – I mean, I'm not saying that they were motivated by that. But to me, it didn't – I didn't feel that from it. I felt either they were trying to copy – the Foley bump, and it was kind of iffy on what, you know,
right.
I think going right off the air doesn't help either. If they'd have like replayed it a bunch and made like a big, because the thing about, you know, the Foley bump, is they replay it so many times in the
yeah.
moment, and they're able to do that because, you know, they're stretching them out and all that. I mean, it's part of the angle. So
right.
They structured that very well. They didn't right. do that here. It doesn't feel nearly as big, and it leads to, if I recall correctly, it leads to Canyon coming back and then turning heel on Paige, and then
right. And then he does this sort of, he comes back as kind of a DDP imitator gimmick.
Positively Canyon.
Positively Canyon doing random diamond cutters on people. And it, by the way, if you've never seen this, it is brilliant, I think.
Yeah, I.
I love it.
That would require a rewatch from me because I vaguely remember it, but I was sort of like you. Like, I was watching it still, but my watching was less active than it had been in 97 or 99.
Well, I have had a long appreciation for Canyon all the way back to, all the way back, not all the way back to Men at Work, unfortunately, but at least back to Mortis. I've always been a fan of his, and yeah, the Positively Page thing was just hilarious, I thought.
And funny given, of course, Paige being the guy that he is now, the
Right.
motivational speaker yoga guy.
Right. And he, but even back then, the I believe he had a book that he had put out at that point. This is worth checking.
He had a biography. Yeah, it was Positive Page. Yeah. So,
Right.
I mean, it was a biography, but also like a motivational thing. So, I mean, he was doing
Right.
that even then, but obviously that's what he's,
Yeah, he and now he's got this reputation for the yoga thing and all that, right?
Yeah. So that is the match. But I would say it is a it's not like it's a must watch, but interesting
Right.
enough, it's in engaging enough, and doesn't come off as a disaster. I feel like the Arquette, like it would have been better without the Arquette work, I guess. But it wasn't like that came off as, it came off bad in content. Shenanigans wasn't necessarily bad in and of itself.
Right, exactly. And as I was thinking about this, I was trying to figure out, what do you do, excuse me, instead of having Arquette in that match? And it's like, I guess you just do straightforward Jarrett Page. I can't get my head around the ending. I guess maybe the ending is more New Blood kind of stuff where somebody else comes out and stops it. But I feel like on the whole, it pays off, and I think it's at least worth a look. From, it's been so widely panned, and I don't think it deserves the sort of, it definitely doesn't deserve the sort of derision that it's
Right.
gotten.
Yeah, the match, man. The story.
Yeah.
I mean,
The story's a little meh.
yeah, right.
Having said that, I will say this. I do like, because the next night they do the promo with Bischoff and oh God, who else out there? Bischoff, Kimberly, Mike Awesome, and Arquette in his ridiculous yellow green pimp suit
Yes.
all come out. And Bischoff's motivation, the idea that we had Arquette win the belt. Just because Arquette or Bischoff gets just such a giddy sick thrill out of messing with DDP. I liked that. And I don't know if it would have worked with somebody besides Arquette if it was the right angle with the wrong guy, but it's a good bad guy idea. Like, look at what we did to what you have. We made it into a laughing stock and then made you look foolish. So I don't know. I think that's good bad guy
Right.
motivation.
Although I the tortured explanation of Bischoff trying to explain like how it was all part of this master plan and then trying to explain like
Oh
every
God, he goes full on Bully Ray with it.
So okay, that's an interesting thing because it's the beginning of Nitro and they go over like they talk about Canyon first. They hammer that home, which is good because that's you intend to be a big serious thing. So then the camera focuses on Eric Bischoff and Mike Awesome. Like you see David Arquette a little bit toward the side, but you don't see a full shot of him until they get into the ring. And you don't see Jeff Jarrett is not mentioned or seen until they get into the ring and he like holds the title up.
Right. And yeah, I didn't even see Jared up to that
Right.
point. And also, on a related note, why is Jarrett dressed as one of the Quebecers? He's got this like ridiculous red vest on and he looks like Pierre.
He does. Well, I don't, that's an excellent question. That was kind of a normal outfit for him at the time too.
That's
Yeah.
true. That's
And
true.
the cat, Ernest the Cat Miller was there too. They were like wondering, the cat, what's
Yeah,
happening now?
where do
What's
you come
going
from?
on? And
he came out of the same hole that Mike Awesome came out of. It's the new blood wormhole that
right.
they have.
Now, does Arquette seem drunk in that promo?
Arquette seems so drunk. Oh my God.
Because he also seems very drunk. When he was on Raw a couple years ago, he also seemed drunk. And
yeah.
I learned that, yeah, David Arquette also admitted around the time that he had an alcohol problem and has been in rehab and stuff. And has some issues with that.
Right.
So, which of course is a sad thing. But
right.
But yeah, that was like he was like he kept saying "was up," and
I think he was saying "shat."
Yeah, he was kind of saying them both.
Shut up, was up. Because it was 2000 and everybody was
right,
saying
but he was
up
rambling like nonsensically, and it was weird. Like it would,
he was almost trying too hard. He was like a guy trying way, way, way too hard to be Andy Kaufman.
Yes, okay.
And you know he was doing the "you don't trust me, I'm from Hollywood."
Yes, that is an excellent way of putting it, and that is exactly what he was going for. And it was not the out. Great,
it was,
and, but the you know the yeah,
it just sort of ends. One of the announcers says, "Well, somebody shut." I think it was actually Madden who said, "Well, somebody shut him up." And then Jarrett just kind of takes the microphone. It's just like, "Well, all right. Anyway, hi, I'm the champion
yeah.
now."
So
to be cool. UDP. And then it's just like Arquette gets a diamond cutter and then is never mentioned again
yeah.
until I think New Blood Rising, where he inexplicably shows up, does a thing, and then gets a buff blockbuster and then is never seen again.
Really?
Yeah, he shows up at
yeah.
Blood Rising. I think it's New Blood Rising. It's a match with
Bagwell and Canyon.
Bagwell and Canyon, and it's Judy Bagwell. God bless Judy Bagwell. I do not understand why she kept being involved in these things. But she's up there. Yeah, Arquette comes out. Arquette goes after Bagwell. Bagwell still wins the match. And then Canyon gives the Canyon cutter to Arquette because Arquette can't do anything
right.
There you
go. So.
So there you go. And that was indeed the last time we saw David Arquette in WCW.
Yeah, and then he made two WWE appearances. One was on SmackDown on February 8th, 2002, according to Wikipedia. I'm going to just go ahead and assume that's right.
I've never seen
that. He just was in the crowd, apparently, holding up a sign that said former WCW champ.
Right.
And then and then during the Slammies, he was the host of Raw. And I guess he also was in a 2-on-1 handicap match with Alex Riley against Randy Orton.
That sounds like a thing that happened.
Yes.
I don't even have a noun there. I just think it just
I bet
wow.
he was better in the match than Alex Riley was.
I bet
yeah.
he was.
So yeah, so that is basically what happened. Anything else? Before we get into Twitter questions,
I'll just say once again, you know, time heals all wounds. Give it a shot, especially if you're the kind of person who's never seen it before and only knows it from its reputation. If nothing else, the cage match, you know, it's so full of great visuals. I think it's a fun match. So you know, and it's not brutally long.
Yeah,
so,
it's like 15 minutes or so. So
give it a shot if you got some time to kill.
It's
you
an
know, it doesn't deserve all the scorn.
It's an interesting slice of the time.
Right.
So you certainly have to give it that.
Right.
So our first question is from Luke Starr at Over as Hell. How do we feel about DDP as the company's top face?
Well, the crowd was into him at this point. I'll say that.
Yeah, that's true. I do feel like, to me, he felt stale. He felt very old hat, and he was kind of one of the guys that it felt like should have been not necessarily like in the title picture, but should have been maybe putting over the, you know, some new faces
right.
kind of thing.
Well, he's putting over Jared.
Yeah, but Jared feels like a retread. Jared's not the kind of guy, you know.
Yeah, and Jared's
Jared.
Anyways.
I like Jared for a lot of things, but I don't. Yeah, he's not the guy you want to build around. And it seemed
right,
pretty clear
right.
even at this point.
Yeah, and you know, which is strange given that Jarrett's entire gimmick at this point was he's the chosen
Sure.
one. He's the one that the top guys had hand selected to lead the company. It was and so, and for a guy like, I don't know, Jeff Jarrett, it just feels like, well, if anybody's going to get there by virtue of being hand selected, I guess it's going to be Jeff Jarrett.
Yeah.
But Paige, you know, maybe short term, I don't know how well he works as the face of a company. And, you know, thank God they had Booker on deck shortly after
right.
this.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, like I get, he's like a good supporting player, but he should not be a main player very often, except maybe like in limited circumstances. And
right,
for the most
right.
part in 98, 99, they used him in 97, 98, they used him fairly well that way.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And he was fresher then, and you know, and was a new guy, and wasn't like one of the, you know, he was actually a guy that was built up and rose to that level, one of the few guys
yeah,
they were able
exactly.
to do that with. So
and he had, you know, he had a story, he had an arc, and everything was really consistent with him, but by 2000 it was just, you know, he'd been doing it for 4 or 5 years, it just felt really long for the tooth
exactly.
at that point. So
yeah. I mean, he was popular. I mean, you give him that.
Yeah.
yeah. So
mm-hmm.
Martin Dixon at Bunny Suicida. Would history be kinder to this if it didn't involve the world title but a lesser belt?
Yeah. Oof. Maybe. I feel like wrestling fans are always going to look for something like this to get really mad at, on one hand. On the other hand, I don't know if I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I don't think it would have gotten the same level of criticism if it hadn't been the world. If it had been the U.S. title, the TV title, or whatever, I think people would have been. Like, I'm not saying they would have loved it, but it would.
Well, a lot of what you hear about it is this was the belt that Ric Flair held. You know, they list off the big list of these are the guys who had the WCW championship. And, you know, going back to, you know, whether or not you want to trace the lineage of that belt back to Crockett Promotions or what have you, and in turn all the way back to the old NWA, you know, that's your decision now where you choose to interpret it. But, you know, I think that there's something to that, and that a lot of the criticism does come from this was the Flair belt. This was the belt that meant something, and the WWE had been, you know, switching their title around so much by this point that WCW belt may have felt like sort of, you know, if nothing else, it represented something older. And it always, WCW has talked about tradition. If you remember, one of the big selling points of the NWO angle was tradition, whatever that was supposed to mean at the time. And so, yeah, I think the WCW belt in particular was really vulnerable to this sort of hatred, given this type of angle and given its history.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And given the way it was presented, which is, you know, just as important, I think.
Next question is from Brian Mays at I Can't SPLLE. Yes. Would you go back in time and not book this match?
If I have a time machine, no, I'm killing Hitler. I'm sorry. I got more important things to do than worry about the WCW title if I got a time
right.
machine. Sorry.
I would say if I had a time machine and was limited to only being able to change WCW's past, I would have made other decisions that more important than this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. This was not really – this did not feel like a defining – downturn point. And if it only comes down to WCW, then, you know, take it back to, you know, even a year before, if you go to the NWO suddenly turns babyface after beating up Ric Flair for 15 minutes in a
right.
field, you know, something like that feels a lot more detrimental to a company just because it's pure nonsense than something like this, which, while maybe not being the best idea in the world and definitely not being in the best circumstances, still had at least a kind of logic
right,
to it.
Right. And Donald Desher at Vitamin D Wrestle. Would you rather watch the sequel to this match or Rock Cena 3?
Well, the sequel to this match is going to have DDP, so that's an obvious answer for me. I love
okay.
DDP.
You know what? Honestly, I could see, I would enjoy DDP, Jeff Jarrett, and David Arquette in 2013.
Yeah, I think I'd
like
that. I feel like
we need to make that happen.
All right, let's get DDP
let's,
on
let's
here
get a
some
Kickstarter
week.
Going.
That's how everything
exactly
fun,
yeah
get a
you know what, let's do it.
All right. And he has to. He's obliged by the laws of the
yeah,
internet.
Yeah, exactly.
If we
and we'll promote whatever, you know, we'll promote his Scott Hall rehab stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. We'll get other people yeah. in there. We'll get friggin' Chip Mitten.
There you
in
go.
There.
Hey,
is Chip Mitten still alive?
I think maybe not, but
Chip Mitten, for those of you who don't know, was a WCW Saturday Night Jobber who was an Olympic bobsledder.
Yes, he is still alive. Chase Tatum is not alive, though.
Chase yeah. Tatum.
Yeah, I got God them sort of mixed up, but
that's all right.
Chase Tatum was a No Limit soldier.
Yeah. Right. And Chip Mitten was an Olympic bobsledder.
Yeah, he apparently works for a Christian athlete ministry based up.
That's right. I knew that. Kind of a power team
yes.
type thing. I knew that.
It's called
that.
Team Impact.
Yes.
Our next question is from Patrick Brogan at TL Hobo.
Friend of mine.
Does Jeff Jarrett get unfairly maligned? That's question one.
No. I can understand. Jarrett's always had a sort of mediocrity about him. He's always felt like he's always been sort of a step above what he feels like his station should be, even when he was just the guy in the weird suspenders hanging out with the horsemen. So I think he's a good hand to have around, but I don't think he's a guy that you build a wrestling promotion around.
Yeah, I think he's had some highlights in his career in which he has been excellent, but most of his career he has been pretty okay to fairly good.
Right. Right. And so it's hard to, I think he, you know, he gets a lot of hatred. I have a hard time getting really excited one way or the other, to be honest. I can't get too mad at him because he's all
sure.
right. So unfairly maligned, maybe a little, but I kind of understand where people are coming from.
I would agree with that. I do think he's a better performer than people give him credit for, but I agree right. that he has been pushed still higher than his talent level for a lot of his career.
Right.
It's weird because I find him really personally engaging. Like when he's like a real life, he's talking out mm-hmm. of character. He seems like really interesting and like a really genuine and like a, you know, like a guy I would want to hang around. And when he's in that
right.
wrestling character, that's less so.
Right.
He's a little bit better out of character in his older TNA days than he was in the 90s and you know, than those runs. But still,
right.
he's definitely worse in those circumstances.
Oh, sure.
And then I believe our last question, no, two more questions. One is the second one from Patrick. Would Oliver Platt have been a better WCW champion?
Holy God, no. Oliver, this is where I'm coming from here. And I actually recorded a podcast with who was it? John DeLong, a Three Count Blog, about Ready to Rumble. And one of the things I remember saying about it is that I thought Oliver Platt was just about the least convincing professional wrestler I have ever seen in a movie. He's this vulgar sort of kind of quasi Jerry Lawler character. His guy's named Jimmy King. He does a lot of like kind of like dick and ass joke type promos. And his finisher is a double axe handle. And I'd as soon put Martin Landau in this role than see Oliver Platt. No, Oliver Platt was my least favorite part of Ready to
Really,
Rumble.
That's interesting because the podcast that I have done a Ready to Rumble podcast as well with the boys from Kayfabe Comedy, and we thought Oliver Platt was actually the best part of Ready to Rumble.
Really?
We just thought, like, I agree that he is not convincing as a wrestler, but I think one that's kind of the point, that's kind of the character, he's kind of this doofus who is sort of because he's popular with the crowd for whatever reason, they keep him around even though he's not in shape and even though he's hated by everybody else. And I just thought some of the weirdness that he brought to that character made it funny and made it a lot better than it was written.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I straight up didn't care for it.
So,
we have a difference of opinion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't think he would have fit well into the thing though, because he didn't have the athletic stuff.
No.
But I thought we just speculated whether Arquette's buddy in the movie, Scott Conn, would
Scott
have been,
Conn.
because he kind of was more. He's more muscular. He kind of like felt like he could have held up his end of the, you know, at least of like the physical stuff better. But Arquette did fine with that. So,
yeah.
So,
Arquette.
Yeah.
All right.
And then the last question is by Ryan Foster at Foster versus World. We kind of covered this a little bit, but this is taking it from a different angle. Could DDP have been successful as a top babyface in a more stable WCW?
In a more stable WCW, maybe, but not in 2000.
Yeah.
1998, definitely.
Right.
Coming off of the really hot feud with Randy Savage, yes, by all means. And I really think that's something they should have done with Paige in 98.
Yeah, I mean, he did have Hogan. I mean, you know, he was involved in feuds. He had a title match with Goldberg. I mean, you know, they did stuff with him in '98, yep. But
yeah, but they never quite put the rocket on him. He felt oddly he felt like in '98 the way we felt like he should have been used in 2000.
Right.
He was kind of a utility guy. He would come out, have matches. He would say Hollywood scum Hogan every week, and
he would. He certainly did.
He did say Hollywood. That's one thing. If you've never seen WCW in 1998, watch 1 week of WCW in 1998, and you have seen every week of WCW in 1998.
That is pretty much true. Yeah,
because it was just that kind of year. There were if there are 52 weeks in 1998, there were 52 Hollywood scum Hogan promos.
Yeah, there was. That is a very good way of putting it. A lot of them were great though, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I honestly, like, I could see there's this reputation of Bob Backlund's championship time in WWF as, like, Backlund kind of having, you know, he's the champion but really was not the primary focus of the promotion for a lot of the times. And I don't know how true that really exactly is, but there's that reputation. And I feel like Paige on top, that would have been, if he had been champion and kind of had like a 5 month thing with the belt or whatever, it would have felt like that, or it would have felt like Undertaker felt like in 97 when he was champion. Where,
just sort of part of the furniture.
Yeah, I mean, his stuff would have been important, but it would have been like the third most important thing on the show.
Right. And another thing about Paige, one thing I really like about him, I feel like Paige really works better when he's coming from underneath. You know, especially in 1997, 98, when he had this sort of, you know, he was an underdog character. He looked sort of scuzzy. He was a former manager. You know, the only reason he was ever back in wrestling was because he had a mysterious benefactor. So he kind of had this image of this guy pulling himself up by the bootstraps, and it works really well for him. I don't know how well that works when you stick him on top. It's sort of like the Steve Austin dynamic, where Steve Austin's always kind of trying to overcome odds. But the difference is that Austin always felt like the best guy, and he felt like you had to stack the odds against him just to bring him down to your level. Whereas Paige just feels like some guy who's constantly fighting upward, upward, upward. So I don't know that it quite works with him as the focal point of an entire company.
I agree. And I think, you know, he had a good personality, but it wasn't great. Like, Paige did a lot of things well or pretty well, but the stuff he did great, I don't think there was that much of it, you know?
Right.
You know, so yeah. Well, that's all Twitter. Go ahead.
But I like
him. I like him
like
too.
Paige.
I enjoy him. But I enjoy him about as much as I enjoy Jared. Maybe a little more, but... but I feel like both those guys are, you know, like they're fine, they're good, and they've had their great moments, but for the most part, they're a good workman, like it's utility guys. Yes. So,
yeah.
So that's it. Anything else that you want to, discuss or, before you plug whatever you'd like to plug?
No, I'm just, again, I'll say it again. If you've never seen it, if you've resisted seeing it, but you're kind of curious, give it a chance. You might be pleasantly
Yeah,
surprised.
I agree
So
with that.
that's pretty much sums it up. Pretty much sums
All
it up
right,
for me.
cool. Anything that you want to mention that you're working on?
Okay, well, first of all, I've contributed an article a few weeks back to the Mandible Claw, Daniel Matheson's site, themandibleclaw.wordpress.com. Presumably, everybody who's listened to this show. Have you had Daniel on
I
here?
have, yes.
Oh, good, 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 good. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Daniel and I like her stuff. And so I hope to be contributing more things there in the future. My blog is Bill at the End of the World, all one word, Bill at the End of the World.wordpress.com. I talk about teaching stuff mostly, writing stuff mostly. I am also right now offering an anthology that I have contributed a short story to. That short story is called Kayfabe. It's set in 1978 and it is about wrestling. So you guys might enjoy it. If you can pick it up on Amazon and you can get it in the ebook way that way. But if you buy it from my website, I will not only ship it out to you, but I will autograph it. So someday when I become famous, you can sell that on eBay for a few million dollars or however much it'll be worth. I'm going to say a few million dollars. I have self-confidence. And one more thing, you can follow me on Twitter at Bill at the End, Bill at the End, all one word. I'm a lot more humble there than I am right now. So
Seems fair, but you're insightful.
I do try to be. I do try
Yes.
to be.
All right. Well, of course, everyone can check us out on Twitter at WrestleSpective, Facebook the same as well. If you are enjoying the show and you want to somehow help us become better known, a good way to do that is to leave a review and a rating on iTunes. Preferably a good one, you know, and check out redundapress.com if you are interested in venturing into making your own website and podcast, so on and so forth. Everyone, again, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.
Toodaloo.